Unfortunately, it's time to make a video that I have never wanted to make, to be honest, because I have been living in a very blissful ignorance right up until April 19th, when my worldview was rocked and shattered by the Torture Poets Department, and I learned that for a very brief moment in time, or perhaps actually even much longer than that, Maddie Healy, lead singer of the 1975, and who I like to call The Rat, was Taylor Swift's love of her life. In today's video, I'm going to be giving you a comprehensive timeline of their relationship going all the way back to 2014, and also giving you a very spicy, in-depth lyrical analysis of what I have surmised so far to have been some revisionist history about Maddie Healy. And let me tell you, it doesn't just start at folklore. I think it might start even a little bit earlier than that, but not 1989, which I will get into very shortly. I am many things in this world, but a Maddie Healyologist is simply just not one of them. So a lot of the information that I've compiled in this video was actually pulled from the Spicy Size Maddie Healy Taylor Swift timeline. So what I've done is kind of pulled together the highlights of that, added my commentary and analysis. But if you're looking for a very detailed play-by-play of what happened throughout all of these years between them, I will leave that linked down below. And also, my name is Zach. Welcome back to my channel. I'm the Swiftologist. I make thoughtful weekly videos about pop culture. Over 50% of you that watch my videos aren't subscribed, and I find that really rude. So please rectify that right now, and let's just get right into it. Off the top, I want to get a few things clear. I was extremely supportive of this relationship interlude when it happened. I have a few little narcs in my comment section that keep trying to gotcha me by saying the line in But Daddy, I Love Him about fans judging this relationship was directed at me. But if you knew anything about anything, you would know that I was one of the only Swifties with a platform that actually dared to support Taylor publicly, because I support women's rights and women's wrongs. And I have also stated multiple times that I don't really give a you know what about who she dates, because I'm here for her and her music. A man's actions could never impact my opinion of Taylor Swift. Her ex-boyfriends are immediate flops to me one way or another, and her current boyfriends, I just let them rock until they become exes. I am interested in these men as characters and the story that she's writing on the records. And anywho, if you need evidence of me supporting this relationship interlude, there is plenty of it. I was an extremely vocal critic of the absurd Speak Up Now movement, which is almost certainly what she's referencing in But Daddy, I Love Him. I think what confuses stupid people is that I actually do strongly dislike Maddie, but that is completely separate to Taylor Swift and has nothing to do with them dating. I'm from Singapore, and he had a whole debacle in this region, in Malaysia specifically, a country that is very close to me, where he did some pretty destructive virtue signaling about gay rights, got an entire festival canceled, and spoiled a bunch of local queer people's income. That is where my bone to pick with Maddie Healy comes from. That's why I don't like him. That's why I call him the rat. But that has nothing to do with Taylor, and it is also not her fault. So don't mistake me for something I'm not, unless you have receipts, which you don't because you made it up in your head. But either way, sadly, Maddie is very relevant to me now because he is the latest and greatest muse. I always try to analyze the ex-boyfriends as muses by their contributions to the canon and the discography. The Tortured Poets tea, lore, content, music, information has been an absolute treasure trove of context and new revelations that I simply have to clap and cheer to the rat for. I think we can all admit that Joe as the Muse was getting extremely boring. We get it, you don't wanna go outside, you hate dating a famous person, you're ignoring her, she wants to be jeweled. What Maddie has brought to the table is something that we haven't seen from Taylor basically since she was dating Jake Gyllenhaal in the Red era, the searing burn of her being dumped unceremoniously and led astray. When you really think about it, Taylor has been the antagonist in most of her relationships post that, either initiating the breakups from Harry to Calvin, Tom, and now Joe. Even when she was upset about the decision to end something, it was more often than not generally on her terms. Maddie Healy has thrown a spanner into the works, and I believe he has brought out a rare competitive creativity in Taylor Swift. I felt this when she broke up with Jake too, for Red, someone who she clearly felt very inferior to intellectually. She strove to shore up this misalignment in herself by creating an album so diverse, so well-written, that it was undeniably great art that even he, the most pretentious man in the world, would have to respect. All Too Well? Hello? Tom Hiddleston could not inspire such greatness. Calvin Harris couldn't even inspire a song like Girl at Home. Taylor is at her most acute 24-carat plated Taylor Swift when she is settling scores. Deep down, she is a score settler. She uses her pen for vengeance when real life gets the better of her. And real life certainly got the better of her when it came to Maddie Healy. A very top-line summation of their entire relationship, I believe, can be found in the song Chloe or Sam or Sophia or Marcus, which you will hear me reference many times throughout this video, as it is the Rosetta Stone that keeps revealing information to us. If you want to tear my world apart, just say, you've always wondered. They were a brief interruption, a slight malfunction, a glitch in the matrix, if you will, way back in 2014. They never got the chance to fully live out a relationship in the open. If they were able to achieve anything other than a few casual hookups, it was conducted under the most intense layers of secrecy that it could never possibly feel quite real, in my opinion. Looking back through the discography, we can see this unanswered question peeking its way through her psyche as her forever love with the heirloom turkey began to disintegrate. The idle mind is the devil's devil's playground after all, and the devil was doing hopscotch and cartwheels in that big brain of hers while her boredom ran bone deep. Sadly for me, it's all over folklore, from the wistful longing of the one to the fantastical remembering and projections of illicit affairs. It continues all the way through Midnights as well, culminating in the show-stopping, never-been-done-before derangement of question. That this song is the only intertextual occurrence in her discography with the verbal callback to Out of the Woods at the beginning of the song, signaling to us that it's about Harry Styles when it is very much likely about Matty Healy, makes it a true red herring that is very distressing to me. I think there's a couple ages to discuss here of their relationship, or at least eras of their relationship. We have the Neolithic period, where Matty and Taylor were kind of orbiting each other in public, making indirect and also direct contact from time to time, which is maybe like 2013 to the middle of 2014. And then we have the Middle Ages, which is where there was kind of like low-key a flurry of activity between the two of them, and a lot more going on behind the scenes from the end of 2014, probably until she starts dating Calvin. Then it was the Ice Age, where there was radio silence pretty much from one party, but constant provocations from the other. And then we have the Renaissance, which was spearheaded largely by Ms. Swift and her desperation to escape the confines of Turkeydom. And finally, we have the Information Age, knowing everything that we do about how it all played out. Let me just get one thing straight before we get into this. Nothing on 1989 is about Matty Healy. There is some truly delusional revisionist history spreading around at the moment that say that certain songs that cover similar emotional terrain as to what's present on TTPD also exist on 1989. You guys do know that there are only so many feelings that a person can have, right? And you can experience them with more than one person. Matty and Harry interludes actually have a lot in common. They were both brief, intense, and ended badly and suddenly. It may seem to you like there's more overlap in the Matty Healy Taylor timeline with the 1989 writing process than there actually is, but let me reassure you, there is pretty much none, no opportunities. The last song that Taylor wrote for 1989 was in February of 2014, and it was Style. That is just patently not about Matty Healy. Her relationship with Harry was literally the beating heart of this record, and many of the themes that we hear about on Style are also covered on All You Had to Do Was Stay and I Wish You Would, which were songs that were written and recorded in early 2013, before Taylor was even aware of who Matty Healy was, because the 1975 record didn't come out until September of 2013. This Love, a song that a lot of people like to say was about Matty Healy that she did perform and dedicate to him at the Eras Tour, also was written way before they actually met. So I just thought it was important to get that on the record. So let's begin in the Neolithic age. Okay, with that out of the way, they've basically been horny on main for each other since like the very start. From the jump, Matty is talking about Taylor in interviews. Matty claims that he was asked to tour with Taylor.
Taylor Swift offered us to go on tour. That was cool. It was like, we can't, but that is really nice. Thank you very much.
But the timing when he said this kind of makes it a little bit improbable. She was over halfway through the Red Tour at this point. I suppose it could have happened, but again, Matty Healy just be talking. Matty wears a 1989 shirt on stage. Taylor sees it, she reblogs it, and says, what, fangirl behavior. She joined Tumblr in 2014 and got hooked on the rap. Many such cases from the girlies of that time. She also calls the 1975 her favorite band. Then it's just more kind of like fangirl behavior, except she's not just liking pictures of him in her shirt, she's liking regular old fan-made thirst gift sets of him talking about cats. As a veteran Swiftie who was actually around and present on Tumblr at the time, we weren't really checking for the Matty Healy interactions. She had so successfully just bludgeoned us with the, I'm single and I don't need a man, I just want my girlfriends, at this point that it was like almost sacrilegious to suggest that she may be interested in a man ever again. We had so much food to devour as well from 1989. This was right after it came out. People weren't really paying attention, but there was definitely gossip in the tabloid realm. Ms. Swift lives out her superstar Taylor's Version fantasy and swoons by the side of the stage as Matty Healy performs The City, a now iconic song in the extended Taylor Swift cinematic universe. We know for sure they hung out there because they made a little video for someone's daughter. And you know what? Look at the angle of Taylor's head in this video. She's keen.
Look who I have next to me. Look who I have next to me.
Hi, kitty. I signed some stuff for you earlier, so you should get that soon.
Love you, baby. Bye-bye.
Matty then follows Taylor on Twitter after this. Taylor then returns the favor and dons a 1975 shirt on one of her endless pop walks. You know, this was literally charity work. At this stage, Taylor promoting her project was more valuable than gold. She was on fire and everything she touched also turned to gold. Taylor continues to like posts on Tumblr, comparing them side by side, wearing their shirts. Now, this is where I was kind of like, huh, why are we doing that? Matty is also gushing about Taylor in the press. He says she's an amazing role model, and not only that, but she's an incredible songwriter, an incredible pop songwriter, which I think is even harder. I can't speak highly enough about Taylor Swift. Then we get into the Middle Ages. At the end of 2014, Taylor attends a 1975 concert with Martha Hunt, Karlie Kloss, and others. I know there are going to be some people that are going to want to talk about other events that happened at this concert, but I'm just letting you know that this is not a zone where you are safe to do so. Matty then dedicates the song Falling For You to Taylor, something he has done more than once apparently. I There are terrifying lyrical parallels with I'm Gonna Get You Back off of Tortured Poets here as well. He said, all we need is my bike and your enormous house. You said, someday you might when I'm closer to your height. Till then, we'll knock around and see if you're all I need. Now, this song I'm pretty sure was on the record that came out before they were friends or before they even really knew each other. So I think, again, this is like a retroactive repurposing, saying this is about someone. She says, whether I'm gonna be your wife or gonna smash up your bike, I haven't decided yet, but I'm gonna get you back. Whether I'm gonna curse you out or take you back to my house, I haven't decided yet, but I'm gonna get you back. So interesting parallels there. Maddie's song is basically about what Question is about, two ships passing in the night, wondering what could have come to fruition if a fair shot had been given. Taylor is using Tumblr likes a lot to reveal her inner machinations. She likes a post about this event. He also chooses the stage as the medium for divulging secrets that he probably shouldn't. In New York, he says, I was sad the other day as someone told me they loved me and I said, no, you don't, not really. He was talking to a fan. And then today I told someone I loved them and they said, no, you don't. And it sucks to hear that, especially when you mean it. Don't do that to someone. Don't do what I did. Interesting. Who are you professing your love to, dear? Then he's like subtweeting her on Main on his Instagram, posting these weird poetry about loving someone. He posts and deletes it within a day. And the first line of what he posts is, I love you. I cannot help this hope. I love you. It's ruining my life, period. At the beginning of 2015, they are almost certainly not together officially. However, this is when they are both technically single, and there's literally like 1 month from January until February where they could have perhaps overlapped. Maddie says in an interview that they exchange numbers, but it didn't happen. As amazing for me as it would be if it did, unfortunately, it didn't. He definitely goes on to contradict himself about this specific timeline later on.
Yeah, we met each other. We exchanged numbers in the same way that a lot of people in this kind of world do. Mm-hmm. And we spoke occasionally, and then she's the biggest pop star in the world. I'm in Australia. There's no like relationship yeah. or anything happening. It's just funny how people really, really buy into that.
Yeah. You know?
Maddie is then dating Halsey for a brief period of time, and Taylor is working on sowing her wild oats. And she's just about to meet Calvin Harris as well and officially close that very short window of time when Maddie and Taylor were both kind of single. Their last encounter, where this could have been a possibility for them to have linked up, was at the Brit Awards after party. This is an essential date and moment to remember because it is also the first night that she met Calvin Harris, boo hiss, introduced by Ellie Goulding. My feeling in this period of time is that they may have been sneaking around casually hooking up here and there, but if that did happen, it was extremely brief, and it might have coincided with the beginning of the Calvin Harris interlude as well. All right, now we're in the Ice Age. What we can really gather from this timeline is that one of these people loves to run their mouth, and it's not Taylor Swift. Towards the end of 2015, this is when Taylor was really at the peak of her powers, the crowning moment of her imperial phase. Maddie gives an interview saying that the enormity of her life was intimidating, and he compares her to Barack Obama. He does this a lot, and I presume this to mean he's talking about like her entourage as one of the biggest pop stars in the world. That must have seemed very alienating to him. He said, I fell for her a little bit, but everyone falls for Taylor Swift. And I have to say, that's like a movie line. If someone I dated very briefly said this about me in public while I had another boyfriend that I wasn't that happy with, I would be looking over my shoulder too. He said that the day after she'd been to a show, there was a headline with his name spelt wrong in it and it freaked him out. And he said, I'm not ready to indulge in that world and I'm not ready to be judged by that world. So doesn't that just make you think about how many lines of inquiry Taylor's had romantically where her heart has been broken purely because of circumstance, because the gravity of her life is so unique, bizarre, and unforgiving that it's simply not conducive to love or not worth trying to love for most. And even those who try to conquer this big problem, Joe Alwyn, for example, to design their own way of dealing with Taylor's incredible fame, inevitably end up failing. The prophecy. Maddie tries to reach out to her to be in a music video apparently around this time and she doesn't respond. He also starts dating someone called Gabriella Brooks. No idea who that is, don't care. In early 2016, he's running his mouth again, getting asked about her very often actually. Much of what was said during this specific run of interviews would come back to haunt him. This man needs more than a publicist, he needs a ball gag. You literally can't take him anywhere without him accidentally sabotaging his own career or daubing someone else in it. He's still kind of stuck on the peculiarities of her life when talking about her. He said, she was a big fan of the band and we just became friends and we related to each other over how mental our lives were. But when you're with people like Taylor, there are a million people flying around you the whole time and the security guard is talking to that guy and this guy is the new manager. I didn't like the pace of it because it makes me feel confused and I feel like I'm going to miss something. And being perceptive is one of the abilities that I like to think that I have. For someone who has said that they didn't date and didn't spend that much time together, he certainly is recounting having an awful lot of experience being around her and stepping into her world. I suspect their interlude was the subject matter of illicit affairs, to be honest. Whether or not that overlapped with Calvin Harris, I don't know. But you showed me colors you know I can't see with anyone else, and I don't remember who I was before you painted my nights a color I've searched for since. A soundbite of this interview is released after Taylor is, you know, on her high horse shouting down Kanye for being misogynistic at the Grammys, where Maddie is reported to have said that dating her would have been emasculating for him. I don't think that it's a stretch, and I also don't think that that's unfair to say. The journalist who interviewed him writes an op-ed and says his words were misconstrued and says they saw an intelligent and liberal man wrestling with our culture's gender roles. And you know what? I'm going to give Maddie a break for like 1 second and say that I can kind of see what they were getting at here. I suppose it is traditionally emasculating for a man to date a woman who is that rich, powerful, and successful, especially if you work in the same industry where she essentially doms you on charts, sales, and just about every other measurable metric of your own success on a daily basis. Like, that is hard. It's hard to date someone that's not your equal in a public way, especially professionally and regardless of the gender roles. And all I'm going to say here is politics and gender roles, and you're not sure, and I don't know. Either way, he apologizes and calls her the most gracious, hardworking, creatively gifted, and beautiful woman he's had the pleasure to meet. So true. One thing I will say about Maddie is that in regards to Taylor, he has so far, after all these years, kept it classy, which is impressive given the extent of his messy bootsism. She says about as much on Torture Poets too. He didn't treat her bad. He just kind of misled her and lied to her, but he wasn't mean, I suppose is what I'm trying to say. In the middle of 2016, Taylor dumps Calvin and goes on her very highly publicized Taylor Swift World Tour. Maddie is, but of course, still talking about her. He says that he keeps texting Taylor even though she's probably changed her number. So we know that she wasn't responding during this period of time. Cricket. And he gives an interview where I guess he kind of accidentally admits that there was a spark between the two of them that went beyond just casually hanging out. He says, she came to a show and we hung out a bit. We fancied each other, but then we couldn't have it go any further because it would be like going out with Barack Obama. Again, with the president analogy. I reckon that he probably signed an NDA and literally can't disclose that he actually dated Taylor or did anything with her. And I really do think that's what happened because it does seem like they did hook up. Taylor has kind of hinted as much in her work. He was such a simp for her as well, which is why I think it's so crazy to see how all of this shook out in the end, just revisiting everything that he said over the years. Flash forward to 2018, and there's been a true ice age of activity. Taylor's with Joe, and by all accounts, this is their happiest time. Maddie says in an interview while talking about his journal that what's in it are mainly stories that I write about my dreams of being in love with other pop stars.
It's mainly like stories that I write about my dreams of being in love with other pop stars.
This year, he also retweets a meme of Taylor. In mid-2019, Gabriella and Maddie break up. Kind of crazy how he was saying all this stuff about Taylor while they were still dating. I would have been like, girl. But then again, if I was Joe Alwyn, I heard Question, I would also be like, girl. There is so much collateral damage in this entire shebang. It really was a wrecking ball. In an interview, he talks about wanting to produce an album for Taylor, and in the weirdest way, he kind of predicts Folklore.
I think you kind of see it a little bit with Taylor. I'm not never slag Taylor off. I think Taylor's amazing. And Taylor, I want to produce your next album. I've always wanted. You know what I'm going to try and do?
Good start, yeah.
I want Taylor Swift, right? This is before she did it, right? She needs to do. And then before I said it, and he was like, Nebraska. And I was like, Bruce Springsteen. I was like, no, but I was going to say Blue by Joni Mitchell. Why did you say Nebraska? Because that's exactly the same kind of thing. And he was like, well, of course, man. Taylor Swift doing a It's Me on an Acoustic Guitar record. I can't think of a record that would sell more than that.
He says if she ever wants someone to help set up the mics for her little acoustic record, he's there. Little did he know, in like 8 months, he would be listening to said acoustic record and wondering, is this effing acoustic record about us? What we do know in hindsight as well is that Taylor, at some point throughout their years apart, spent a considerable period of time wondering what could have been. I reckon this period of time after Lover came out and before the pandemic happened was when that rumination really started to take place. Her life was starting to look really boring, buying a house in the UK with Joe, hiding from the paps forever, only going on tour and doing like 10 shows a year. She was also getting ready to retire at the ripe old age of 30 in her mind. She talks about this in Lover and Miss Americana, and it seems like a fate that she has resigned herself to but isn't quite happy about. Maddie, during this period of time, retweets a post of this quote about the acoustic record and tags her in it, like he's really just not being subtle. He also tweets, Taylor Swift with an acoustic guitar, doing her Nebraska, doing her Blue. Kill me. First of all, idiot doesn't realize we already have her Blue. It's called Red. But what he's saying here is that he can't wait for Taylor to do an album where she leans heavily into a stripped back sound and her songwriting chops to write beautiful, descriptive, down-tempo songs about stories that maybe are not even only hers. Hello? Folklore. I can't help but think she was taking notes. In January of 2020, Maddie and FKA Twigs start dating, and then we enter the information age. I would say that the creation of Folklore is really where we need to be perking our ears up again for major indicators of a rat on the premises. In early 2020, both of these fools attended the NME Awards, and they did interact. In an interview with Zane Lowe, he said that Taylor was stood behind him, and they ended up catching up, and it was really nice, but it wasn't the time for him to pitch his post-rock Joni Mitchell project. Well, you didn't need to. She was swirling you into all of her poems as you spoke. In 2021, Maddie begins circling Taylor again, working with Jack Antonoff for the upcoming 1975 record, and there's just no way that Messy Boots Jack Antonoff was not involved in their coming together. During that year, though, towards the end of it, Taylor and Jack are working on Midnights, and they must have overlapped in the studio, Maddie and Taylor, I mean, at a few moments throughout this record. Question is sadly starting to make so much more sense. This is also the period of time when You're Losing Me was written. Just FYI, it was like already over with Joe, and she was halfway out the door. She was handcuffed to the way the turkey was feeling for just 1 hour of sunshine. Boo. In the middle of 2022, Maddie and Twigs break up, and Taylor issues her first public contact with him since 2014 by offering the soundbite of "It's So Funny" about their latest record to Pitchfork. He says that he won't be appearing on Midnights when asked about it, and he reiterates over and over again, though, that he would love to work with her. When Midnights comes out at the end of 2022, he posts on Instagram to stream it, and then later posts that he was listening to Hey Steven Taylor's version. Unfortunately, okay, slay, taste. He then says that he did work on something for Midnights, but he says that version of it never came out, he says.
With the Taylor Swift early, she got an early listen.
She heard bits of it, like, through Jack. Yeah.
Did she return the favor with her latest release and let you listen to it before the general public?
Yeah. We actually worked a bit on that, but then the version of it never came out.
Oh, boo!
No. That's not how it works. It was for reasons that are not to be criticized. She's amazing.
I think that what he's referring to, especially because he used the word version, is a whack-ass anti-hero remix that didn't make it to press, and thank God for that. Because those remixes, whew, the Bleachers one was damage enough. Maddie says at the end of 2022 that the song Chocolate reminds him of Taylor Swift. Okay. And Question is added to the 1975 pre-show playlist, which is just like true mental illness that I can't even get into. Then in January 2023, Taylor does a surprise appearance at the 1975 show in London. This was a big deal. She performed the debut of her like hit single that she had not even done an interview for, Antihero. And Maddie says that that evening they stayed up talking until 4 a.m. after that. That is not how you behave with an ex-fling when you're in a long-term relationship. You only act like that when a certain turkey won't let you bejewel. Also, you can detect an inappropriate vibe from these rehearsal pictures. That's a guiltiest sin, girly, if I've ever seen one. That's someone who wants to know if he's written mine on her upper thigh only in her mind. This was also during that period of time when Maddie was making out with people at shows in the crowd every night, which he notably didn't do when Taylor was there.
I'm not kissing anybody in front of Taylor Swift. Have some respect. From the queen.
I think this making out line is definitely referenced in Chloe or Sam or Sophia or Marcus, because that's when Taylor was really starting to consider getting back with him, and he was just locking lips with everyone and anyone around. I think her and Joe are officially done at this period of time, right before Eras, and strategizing on how to handle it for minimal professional impact, mostly for Taylor. Allegedly in February, Maddie and Taylor are recording something together, but I kind of don't believe that because there isn't really a corroborating source. He is seen with some other girl around this time, and the Eras tour officially kicks off. Treepane is issuing puff pieces left, right, and center, saying that Joe and Taylor are great. He's super supportive and excited to see the show when he can. But no Joe at the opening night of the Eras tour really should have been the warning sign, because like, who does that? Even the most pathetic turkey in the world would not stay home and leave his friendship bracelets off. He could at least put like a baseball cap on and glare in the back like he did on the Reputation tour, but no. He wasn't present. About You is playing on the Eras Tour pre-show playlist at this point, by the way, and Maddie's ex says that around this time on March 29th, out of the blue, he stopped replying to my messages and calls. This is a pretty damning eyewitness account, because what happens a mere 2 days later? Taylor swaps out Invisible String, a song about, you know, being tied to the turkey forever, for The One, which is about missing the love of your life that you never got to reunite with. Hello? She was Easter egging, privately, to an audience of one. Maddie follows Taylor on Instagram, likes one of her posts, and then it is his birthday. And what happens on his birthday? Taylor's breakup with Joe is announced. I truly believe this was a troll and a lull between the two of them to do this as a birthday gift to him officially. On that same day, Maddie is waxing poetic about love and how happy he is.
Even if you're good at writing about it, you're not necessarily good at doing it. I'm getting better, and I'm feeling happy, and I'm happy to be here.
And then a few days later, deletes his socials. I think he was definitely taking advice from Treepane at this period of time, and they were all collectively trying to see just how radioactive he would be to the TS brand image. Little did they know. When asked why he deactivated, he said, "Everything happens in eras." Easter egg. The 1975 is a very eras band, and I think that the era of me being a asshole is going to come to an end. I perform all the time, and it's my job, and I love doing it, but I can't perform off the stage anymore as I want to be a bloke. You kicked out the stage lights, but you're still performing. That sounds like someone who said, "You're the love of my life," like a million times and didn't mean it. That sounds like someone who's talking rings and talking cradles and planning to ghost. Maddie starts doing some messy boots behavior on stage. He says, "A call for something sincere and direct. That's what we're all looking for. That's what I'm looking for. Maybe I found it. I'm feeling quite happy," during the shows. Also at the end of You and Me Together song, which is about literally the subject matter of Question. Again, "I've been in love with her for ages and stages. The story needs more pages." He starts cheering. He accidentally introduces Falling for You and lets it slip that, "Oh, this song didn't work as an entrapment for an American singer. Romance is nice," he said, "when it works. This next song worked." Then Falling for You starts playing and he goes, "Oh, it's a different song. This song did not work." T. Maddie says, "It takes a bit to get here, but it's worth it. And true story," before playing Me and You Together song yet again. He also plays a cover of The Starting Line, which we all know has been referenced multiple times on Torture Poets as a ratty talisman. He plays a song called The Best of Me. And here's a selection of those lyrics. "Here we lay again on two separate beds, writing phone lines to meet a familiar voice and pictures drawn from memory. May I also point you to, I dream of cracking locks, throwing my life to the wolves or the ocean rocks. Crashing into him tonight, he's a paradox. I'm seeing visions. Am I bad? Bad or mad or wise?" Dumois starts posting tips about the two of them dating. Even a broken clock is right twice a day. Maddie also kind of hints that a song from his 2016 album is about Taylor, which isn't really a flattering portrayal of her. If so, it definitely alludes to substance abuse by whoever that American girl is. And he says that he sees people listening to She's American in three places: Manchester, okay, Tokyo, sure, and Pennsylvania. Who do you know from Pennsylvania, Matthew? "That's a whole other thing, though," he says. "Don't worry about that." Well, he loves to Easter egg, I'll give him that. And then Watergate happened. Then world stopped. The world was over. And at the beginning of May, The Sun reports that these two modern numbskulls will be going public with their romance at the Nashville Eras Tour. He's still Easter egging on stage with the Me and You Together song, saying, "I've got something real to tell you guys." Can we just take a moment, though, to appreciate this for the messiest pop culture moment of 2023? Like, this was everything. Two painfully self-mythologizing artists rekindling while they were on a jet-setting tour and being very publicly visible. In the same concert where he says, "You know who you are, I love you," he covers The Best of Me again by The Starting Line, and before About You, he literally says, "This is why I'm happy. Who is it about? Who am I talking about? Free us of your nonsense, Matthew." He then writes the letter T on the camera lens and mouths, "I love you." Like, we're getting smoke signals. I can only imagine that all these antics fill Taylor with the kind of joyful, nervous, exciting glee that she hasn't felt since she escaped that getaway car in 2017. Like, there's no way that she would be allowing him to do all this if it wasn't immensely pleasing and romantic to her. He then flies from Manila to Nashville, which is like 20 hours, to bear witness and gaze starry-eyed at Tay Jesus Christ returning home to her very own Tennessean Jerusalem in his goddamn Jehovah's Witness suit. Sadly for me and the koi fish at the Nashville penthouse who died from his stink, he goes home with Taylor. For the record, let me just clarify that I was living and laughing and loving during this time. You can go and watch my videos. I was seated. He is, to be honest, having the time of his life each and every night at the Eras Tour, automatically making him a more interesting public boyfriend than Joe in that moment. These two dumbos are then spotted on a date on a rooftop at Golden Hour, and he then attends two more Philly shows of the Eras Tour, hanging out with Taylor's dad, and Taylor plays This Love as a surprise song with no introduction. These hands had to let it go free, and This Love came back to me. Hello. Again, I don't accept that this was written about him because the timeline doesn't add up, and this was one of the first songs written for 1989, meaning, again, that before the 1975 record even came out and he was of interest to anyone, this song was written. She also plays Hey Steven and says that it was a request, but declines to say from who. It was him, obviously, because of what he posted on his Instagram story. Clearly he loves that song. Then they do their one and only pat walk, exiting Electric Lady, where Taylor is frankly looking bedraggled, I guess, to match her man's. He's back and forth to her NYC apartment quite a bit at this point, and then Taylor gets on the mic before Question and does the most deranged and delusional thing she's ever done.
But you're standing in the pouring rain with people and you just kind of feel like this romantic sense of camaraderie. I was thinking about what song to play with you tonight, and I was thinking there's a song from Midnights that I love so much. I haven't played it on this tour or ever, so I figured that could be fun to play with you. And I just, oh my gosh, this is insane. I kind of just feel like telling you, like, I don't know, just, I've just never been this happy in my life, in all aspects of my life.
Again, as I said at the time, no mentally well person says they're happier than ever and then plays Question. The Sun, which clocked their relationship announcement at the end of May, so around the 27th, says that Taylor and Maddie are moving in together. I mean, that makes sense given what Taylor said about the stuff that he was saying to her, about the seriousness of their future together. Once your queen had come, you'd treat her like an also-ran. However, that's what really happened. Taylor's mentioned multiple times in a New Yorker profile of Maddie, and the writer says that neither of their representatives would comment on the record, but they kept getting texts from people who knew them and insisted that this time it's real. And literally, like a week later, they break up. On the 6th of June, People magazine releases an article saying there is no drama and who knows what could happen again, basically leaving the door open for a reconciliation that must have been at the behest of Tree and Taylor because this is a friendly publication to them and they didn't have to include that detail. Taylor and Maddie still care for one another, but they are in the middle of world tour, so they're incredibly busy. They've been friends for years and are still friends. Really? Really? Do you want your friends to go to jail? While discussing Taylor on his podcast, Zach Sang also says, I'm kind of friends with Selena Gomez. We've known each other for a very long time and we share a lot of close friends. And from what I've heard, like in the aura around Selena, Taylor was talking about Maddie Healy like he was the one. There was also, sadly, a video of Taylor sobbing with her head in her hands getting into a car in Detroit after Eras. I won't share that video here, but it does exist. On the 11th of June, Maddie reactivates his Instagram and he says, you know what's nice? Playing songs in context before playing Me and You Together song. What does that even mean? Maddie is also then very casually mentioning Taylor over and over again, like nothing to do with their relationship, just referencing her as like a pop star and a cultural figure over the next few weeks, which leads me to believe that again, it was all kind of a game to him. It wasn't that serious. And then there is another article from The Sun, I believe, that comes out and says that Maddie and Taylor are back together and they want to make it work at all costs. And here is where I think they kind of did wait to see if they could reconcile after that initial ghosting period. It was, I touch you for only a fortnight, then he ghosts. And then it seems like Taylor was waiting around for a bit to see if he might come back to her. Still alive, killing time at the cemetery, never quite buried, etc. But then People magazine denies the claims that they are back together. At the end of July, Taylor removes About You from the Eras Tour pre-show playlist, and Maddie is seen with Meredith Michelson, I don't know who that is, at an airport in Hawaii. And in August, Taylor starts dating Travis Kelce. You know what my main takeaway from this is? He is the smallest man who ever lived. Like, by all accounts, he was the initiator of so much of this contact through the years, publicly baiting her, but also trying to get at her privately, even when she wasn't responding to him. If I were her and I was being pursued this intensely and referenced this heavily over a number of years and I liked him well enough to begin with and wondered what happened, well then I would start to feel like it was meant to be as well. We also know that Taylor is very superstitious about love. She's into signs and invisible strings and the idea of fate and twin flames and soulmates. And I think that Maddie played directly into that very foundational part of her romantic self with his own antics. And I really do not blame Taylor for being, one, as obsessed as she was, and two, blown apart and flabbergasted as she was when it ended. What rings to me as well is that it happened very suddenly. Like the week before the ghosting or the breakup, the New Yorker is talking about how it's very serious between them and many people in their inner circle are quick to corroborate this. It seems like Maddie's sudden change of heart, pun intended, was a shock to everyone, not just Taylor herself. It was also, I'm sure, highly embarrassing and humiliating to choose to go this public this quickly with someone, receive so much blowback, and then all of a sudden be left alone wondering what the hell happened and why did I do this in the first place. What we are missing from in Tortured Poets is an action moment. There isn't really like a heated fight or a breakup. He literally just drops off the face of the earth and didn't explain why, which is why I think she was driven almost completely to distraction by the situation. Like, his emotional performance just does not match the emotional truth and the devastation that she felt. Now I want to go through some songs and analyze what I think could have been about Maddie Healy. I'm thinking the absolute earliest he could have made an appearance was Lover, and I'm not convinced that anything bar maybe Death by a Thousand Cuts is about him on that record. She didn't really seem to get super engaged with being bored or hating Joe until the end of 2019 anyway, and Lover was written like mostly during their happiest time. Death by a Thousand Cuts, however, is interesting because it does cover some emotional territory that exists on TTPD. You said it was a great love, one for the ages, but if the story's over, why am I still writing pages? You know the greatest loves of all time are over now. There's also a drug allusion here. Gave up on me like I was a bad drug. The bridge of Death by a Thousand Cuts also kind of gives Elicit Affair tea, like there's an intimate and a secrecy, there's like an intimate secrecy of it all. But either way, Death by a Thousand Cuts is an admitted aberration away from the autobiography of her pre-Joe songwriting. In a certain way, I wonder if this song was the gateway drug between feeling confined by writing autobiographically and not wanting to mess things up with Joe, and figuring out that by just doing folklore, she could say all her craziest thoughts imaginable and dismiss them sneakily as fiction. Genius behavior, TBH. So folklore is where we really need to be looking. Important to remember the prominence of a composite sketch here. I don't want to be too binary binary. That's very boring. So I'm not going to say like prescriptively that songs are absolutely 100% about one thing or another. A lot of these things are like a culmination and a combination, but there are a few new ways to consider these songs. And I have to concede, first of all, that the one is very likely about Matty Healy, given how hard she Easter egged it with the set list switch on tour and how conveniently it was axed from the set at the first given opportunity, yet again with the set list reshuffle. If you wanted me, you really should have showed. Well, cricket. You meet some woman on the internet and take her home. That lyric felt like a weird Haler lyric to me because I presumed this was a Haler song, because I know Harry is like not very online, like at all. But you know who is online? You know who has an album called A Brief Inquiry into Online Relationships? Exactly. Mental illness. I think the bridge here is about their chance encounter at the NME Awards. We know Matty was on his best behavior. He at least felt like he was holding back a bit since he couldn't pitch his Joni Mitchell idea to her. Taylor writes, I persist and resist the temptation to ask you if one thing had been different if I hadn't started dating Calvin Harris. Would everything be different today? And I want to take a look at Illicit Affairs, because that was a real and true question mark that makes a lot more sense knowing their earlier history and how there was a strong possibility they were actually hooking up in secret. Something Matty also continuously bested Taylor at was being a wordsmith. Talk to you under the table, for example, interpersonally. He said all the right things and she fell for it. And she realizes this on Illicit Affairs in a verse. Take the words for what they are, a dwindling mercurial high, a drug that only worked the first few hundred times. There's also strong potential for This Is Me Trying to be at least somewhat inspired by Matty Healy. He had just gotten sober when they met during the NME Awards. And you could also find traces of their dynamic in the sister songs on this record, The Triangle, rather, Cardigan, August, and Betty. I think I knew you'd miss me once the thrill expired in Cardigan, haunts me in light of you said normal girls were boring, but you were gone by the morning on The Smallest Man Who Ever Lived. Evermore. Sadly, I think there's ratty tea all over this record, even more than on Folklore. Why don't we just start with Gold Rush? This song is about a maladaptive daydream. She's sitting there pondering what could have happened with someone where things just didn't work out and it never progressed past a quick brush. I always thought the song was about Harry. It's a song about wanting someone that everybody else wants, hair falling into place like dominoes, Matty Healy noted full head of hair, Harry Styles' slow but progressive male pattern baldness. Also, at dinner parties, I call you out on your contrarian. Sadly for Harry Styles, he is head empty, no thoughts. It's elevator music in there. He's also very like agreeable and charming and an affable character. And it seems like most of Taylor's guys that she dated are kind of like that, you know, placid Ken vibe. Who is an annoying contrarian who says dumb stuff for attention and gets in trouble all the time? Matty Healy. I'm also getting from this line, who else decodes you? Who else is going to know you? I think some things I'll never say, like who uses typewriters anyway? She gets him. She thinks he's cringe, but she also loves that about him. And she feels weirdly connected to him by feeling as though she understands him better than anyone else. I think she's working through the same feeling in multiple different ways here, some fictionally abstracted and some closer to home. But the central feeling on Evermore is a central feeling that is explored on a lot of the songs we know for sure are about Matty. And that feeling is, can I ask you a question? We see this on Tis the Damn Season. The Road Not Taken looks real good now. But also, I am willing to restart this, even momentarily. I'll be yours for the weekend, even though I'm leaving. And the whole conceit of this protagonist going off to LA to become famous and successful kind of mirrors the choice that Taylor made very early on in their brief situationship to prioritize her career and her success, literally as she was in the peak of her imperial phase of 1989, instead of trying to make it work with a bit of an unreliable drug addict. Evidence here also comes from Chloe or Sam or Sophia or Marcus. If the glint in my eye traced the depths of your sigh down that passage in time, back to the moment I crashed into you like so many wrecks do, too impaired by my youth to know what to do. And also, you needed me, but you needed drugs more. Sadly, I think that Cowboy Like Me is my most shocking Matty Healy reframe. This is a really sneaky and clever way to continue exploring the question creatively without needing to water down her feelings or explain why she was so obviously pining for an old flame while in an allegedly healthy long-term relationship with her one and only lover, heirloom turkey, London boy. The construct of Cowboy Like Me is that these two bandits and outlaws who are wise to the ways of the world and smarter than most other people finally meet each other and meet their match. Game recognizes game. Both of these cowboys use their personal life as material for songs. Both of them are creatives who make unpredictable creative decisions that are respected in the industry. Both are considered geniuses in their own right. I've had some tricks up my sleeve, she writes. Takes one to know one. The first verse literally sets up the way that Matty and Taylor sparked and then immediately faltered, that we also hear in Chloe or Sam or Sophia or Marcus. You asked me to dance, and I said, dancing is a dangerous game. You wanted me to date you, and I said, that's not the best idea for my image right now. And after meeting her match, she said, I'm never gonna love again. May I direct you to, does it feel like everything's just like second best after that meteor strike? We also must attend to the bridge to get to the real gags, though. The skeletons in both our closets plotted hard to F this up. The old man that I've swindled really did believe I was the one. And the ladies lunching have their stories about when you passed through town. But that was all before I locked it down. She's literally doing Guilty as Sin. What if he's written mine on my upper thigh, only in my mind? She's envisioning a future where they finally cut the BS and accept that no matter what reputational damage they will face, this is meant to be. The men that Taylor swindled along the way were conned, and the girls Maddie was with just have their war stories to tell about the way he was before Taylor locked him down. And compellingly, it's like Taylor knew in her mind, even though she was guilty of sin and about to be fresh out the slammer with the one she loved and it was going to be perfect, critics be damned, she still somewhere deep down knew it wouldn't last. In the concluding stanza of Cowboy Like Me, we see what seems to be a happy ending after she locks it down. You hang from my lips like the Gardens of Babylon. What's interesting about the Gardens of Babylon reference here is that it was allegedly one of the ancient seven wonders of the world, and it never existed. This entire sketch she's conjuring is, again, another maladaptive daydream. Only in fables and myths did these two bandits and cowboys end up together. And then she follows that up with the most devastating blow and one of my favorite Taylor Swift lyrics ever, "Forever is the sweetest con. I redirect you back to love of my life. What we thought was for all time was momentary. Still alive, killing time at the cemetery, never quite buried." And then Cowboy Like Me ends with, "I'm never gonna love again." And furthermore, just a little bit more evidence, a con man sells a fool a get love quick scheme. There you go. There you go. This is my evidence. Then we get into Ivy, which I think is also very much about a similar kind of longing. I see a lot of parallels here with Fresh Out the Slammer, actually. So our protagonist in Ivy is frozen with inaction. She is completely powerless to this love spell cast upon her by someone from her past, someone external to the binding relationship that she's currently in. In from the snow, your touch brought forth an incandescent glow. Tarnished, but so grand. Let's start with the snow, shall we? What do snow and winter symbolize? I mean, withering, hibernation, death. In Fresh Out the Slammer, when she's described how her and the turkey broke down, she says, "Another summer taking cover, rolling thunder, he don't understand me. Splintered back in winter, silent dinners, bitter, he was with her in dreams." In the winter, she knew it was over, but by the summer, she's still rocking around, hoping that it'll change. Either way, what happens when this new and mysterious lover comes in from the snow? He brought forth an incandescent glow to our lifeless protagonist. Immediately here, I am called back to "You're Losing Me" and "So Long, London." My face was gray, but you wouldn't admit that we were sick, and I'm just getting color back into my face. She compares herself then to a widow who visits her husband's grave every day, only Taylor can't do that because her widow is still alive. Her destiny and fate is sealed, or so it seems, and so all she can do is just sit and wait and grieve for the living and write her composite pining sketches while swirling him into all of her poems because she simply can't stop him from putting roots in her dreamland. And he grows like ivy, which is a fast-spreading weed, over her impenetrable house of stone, where she is handcuffed to the spell she was under for years of labor, locks, and ceilings in the shade of how he was feeling. Then when she says, in Fresh Out the Slammer, "It's gonna be all right, I did my time," I think that ivy is kind of a description of that period of time, that waiting that she's talking about. And again, we circle back to, "Can I ask you a question? I'd live and die for moments that we stole on begged and borrowed time." That too brief period of something in 2014, 2015, "Tell me to run or dare to sit and watch what will become and drink my husband's wine. Get your ass up and tell me if you wish you put up more of a fight. Just say you've always wondered. That's literally all it would take for me to run back home to you." Midnights Now, that is inherently confusing because it is the composite sketch album. Like, it's truly difficult to parse what's going on in certain songs, but it's all starting to make clear. I mean, Maroon is rife with Maddie Healy references, cleaning incense off a vinyl shelf. It's also kind of giving Guilty as Sin if you really think about it, because it skips between a recollection and the present tense so quickly. Like, I do think some of what she's describing here is a dream talk or like an incantation. So Scarlet, it was Maroon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think Snow on the Beach is like the precursor to Down Bad. There is something very celestial and otherworldly about this song too. "Your eyes are flying saucers from another planet, flying in a dream, stars by the pocketful. Did you really beam me up? You're catching my drift." We begin with again, a moment of yearning. "My boredom's bone deep, this cage was once just fine, but now I'm wondering what goes on beyond the bars." In Snow on the Beach, she says, "One night, a few moons ago, I saw flecks of what could have been lights, but it might just have been you, passing by, unbeknownst to me." This really recalls the ship's passing in the night theme about their early years that Maddie and Taylor have both written about, and the unfulfilled potential that I think is also elaborated on in Chloe or Sam or Sophia or Marcus. "As the decade played us for fools," she writes, "and you saw my bones out with somebody new who seemed like he would have bullied you in school, you just watched it happen." And again, at the end of Snow on the Beach, she returns to her secret wish. "I can't speak. I'm afraid to jinx it. I don't even dare to wish it. But Your eyes are flying saucers from another planet, and now I'm all for you like Janet. Can this be a real thing? Can it? First of all, now, pretty baby, I'm coming back home to you. And also, furthermore, now that I know better, I will never lose my baby again. We know the answer to the question of can this be a real thing is, in fact, cooler in theory, but not if you force it, per Chloe and Samus or Fiora Marcus. It was momentary. It was unnecessary. It should have stayed buried. The song actually also really gives me echoes of Treacherous as well. It's like a premonition song. You wanting me tonight feels impossible, but it's coming down, no sound. It's all around like snow on the beach. This slope is treacherous. This daydream is dangerous, but I like it. Maroon. I mean, she more or less tells us directly in Chloe or Sam that this is about the rat, where she wonders if the passage of time will make his memory fade from the scarlet maroon. So scarlet it was maroon is a really weird line that doesn't really make sense. I think what she's really trying to say here is that something so urgent and imposing, the brighter color of scarlet, was possible there. It was so bright and so urgent that it couldn't possibly be picked. And so instead it became maroon, a dulled, muted version of that same color, which is red, obviously. There's something here about their connection being simply too powerful and the two of them just not being able to follow through or even being scared of it. I feel you no matter what, the rubies that I gave up, she says. I struggled with that line for a while because I was like, now hang on, you ended it with Harry. I know you were sad, but you called it off and that was a final decision you had moments of clarity with. Joe was still in the picture, or so we thought at the time. So I was like, now what has she given up for him? Now we know that she truly viewed Maddie Healy as something so precious, like a ruby. I wake with you over me, that's a real legacy to leave. I return back to Chloe or Sam or Sophia or Marcus again. Could it be enough to just float in your orbit? Question is like the most evil thing she's ever done to me personally. She really wasn't kidding when she said red herring, because this is the most torturous possible abuse she could have inflicted upon the Swiftologist as a hailer. Starting it with a sample of her own song, Out of the Wood, notably, famously about Harry Styles, simply saying, I remember. Well, what was I supposed to think? What was I supposed to do with that information? But really, if we had known how much of a big impact Maddie had left on her in that brief period of time, maybe it would have rung true as an Easter egg. But I think it's really only there because it situates us in the 1989 era where she met Maddie, and she's simply just saying, I remember that. This is where she starts toying with the idea of blowing up her life. It's this casual, silly way that she delivers it that really gags me. Like, this song is such a crazy thing to do and say when you're in a relationship. I don't remember who I was before you painted all my nights a color that I've searched for since. Back to illicit affairs. You showed me colors you know I can't see with anyone else. Then she gets into the decade that played them for fools. One thing after another, lost in situations, circumstances, miscommunications. And I have to say, I just may like some explanations. To me, the chorus is still the scribblings of the Zodiac Killer, and I think that it was intended to be understood by one person and one person only, and we know that he understood it because it was on his pre-show 1975 playlist. Do you wish you'd put up more of a fight? When she said it was too much, tell me to run. Tell me to run. Maddie Healy sadly has crescent-shaped eyes, which she says plainly in this song. Half moon eyes. Bad surprise. Did you realize? Out of time. She was on your mind with some dickhead guy that you saw that night, but you were on something. You guys, it's literally all coming together. The night that she's describing here is the Brits after party where she was introduced to Calvin. Maddie Healy, who she was ready and willing to accept as a potential lover, was clearly on some sort of substance and not paying attention to her this evening because he realized out of time that she had already been swept away by a dickhead. I love Calvin Harris being described as a dickhead. So true. And to that I say, you snooze, you lose, rat. That's what happens. And she talks about what else drove them apart, politics and gender roles. Well, yes, we know he felt emasculated by her and he grappled with that publicly in interviews. You're not sure and I don't know. The two of them were not ready to commit and really just got swept away in the gray. Then we get into the bridge, which was truly the world stop moment of the century. Does it feel like everything's just like second best after that meteor strike? What's that I heard? You're still with her? I'm sure that's what's right and what's suitable, but tonight, ooh, messy, messy, messy queen. Elsewhere on Midnights, we know that she's ready to be bejeweled and Maddie's gonna let her do it. She meets the band and he asks, are you still with the Waxman? And she says, I don't remember. I want to take a closer look at Mastermind too. It does kind of fit both Joe and Maddie, but I think this idea of plotting and scheming over a long period of time, truly masterminding and playing the long game, is something that comes up thematically over and over again on TTPD with regards to Maddie. I say this because I think the final twist at the end of Mastermind reminds me of the bandit character parallel on Cowboy Like Me. I'm only cryptic and Machiavellian because I care. First of all, I subliminally message through my songs that I want your body on my fictional albums, which are an idea you basically suggested to me. Sorry for doing that, but it had to be done. Second of all, she says, once I revealed my machinations to you, all you did was simply smile because you knew the entire time that I was doing this. I am the mastermind and I can't get one over on you because you're a cowboy like me with eyes full of stars. Let's get into Glitch because this song is a riddle that has truly been solved. I remember doing the math and I was like, now, what does this mean? So we know that Taylor wrote Midnights at the end of 2021 in about November. 2,190 days is 6 years. 2021 minus six is 2015. What happened in the beginning of 2015? The Brits after party that we just spoke about. The love blackout. More proof, we were supposed to be just friends. You don't live in my part of town, but maybe I'll see you out on the weekend. They lived in different parts of London at this point, depending on what mood and situationship I'm in. You see, I think they did overlap before. That Calvin Harris glitch overlap is way more likely than we thought, divas. I'm not even sorry. Knights are so starry. How many times does she refer to Maddie or her as starry-eyed on Tortured Poets? Well, yes. I was supposed to sweat you out in search of glorious happenings of happenstance on someone else's playground. Let's again return to the key that unlocks every mystery, Chloe or Sam or Sophia or Marcus. I changed into goddesses, villains and fools, changed plans and lovers and rules, all to outrun my desertion of you. Period. A brief interruption, a slight malfunction. It was momentary. It was unnecessary. I felt like I'm crazy. I'd go back to wanting dudes who give nothing. I was better safe than starry-eyed. I rest my case. Hits Different is almost also certainly about Maddie Healy as well. She references switching out her Kens, dating guys who look like they would have bullied the rat in high school, of course. And generally, she talks about how she's obsessed with someone and it's pissing everyone off. I slur your name until someone puts me in a car. I stop receiving invitations. This kind of dovetails with Dear Reader for me as well, where my friends found friends who care. I pace in my pen, etc. She was driving herself and others crazy with this fixation that she couldn't really talk about. The bridge is where we really get into that Maddie Healy tea. I find the artifacts, cried over a hat, cursed the space that I needed, which echoes, I can do it with a broken heart. I keep finding things in drawers, crucial evidence. I didn't imagine the whole thing, as in that space that you needed, girl. You should have kept it there because you could not have imagined how terribly this whole thing would have worked out. She's also describing him quite obviously, a wrinkle in time like the crease by your eyes, dreams of your hair and your stare and sense of belief. I personally feel like his hair looks like a rat's nest, so can't relate to that, but slay Taylor. I felt you and I held you for a while, bet I could still melt your world, argumentative, antithetical dream girl. That really just reminds me of, at dinner parties, I call you out on your contrarian shit. You want to fight with me. You want to fight. Can Maddie Healy fight? Probably not, but Taylor Swift? She definitely can. All right, so that is the end of my Swiftie derangement syndrome for today. Let me know what you thought about my timeline. Did I miss anything? Did you learn something new from this video? What are your interpretations of songs? Have you seen little pieces of Maddie Healy creeping into other songs that I didn't mention? I'd love to hear from you, and don't forget to subscribe to my channel. All right, goodbye, Swifties.